Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast, and ours too. I am your favorite host, TJ, the sentimental Pisces, and I am joined, as always, by...
I'm Aaron.
The ever-skeptical Aries. We're sort of boiling it down to the simple essence of who we are this week. Welcome to April. It is now quite thoroughly into Aries season. It's also planting season for my fellow gardening gays out there. It's a new thing I'm introducing for this...
Planting season.
It is. Well, I mean, if you grew up in a rural area like I did, you know, I'm going to be planting soon, as if you says. So before we begin with this week's episode, we do want to send our love out to the folks at Golden Con. We're very sad that we weren't able to attend this year, but, you know, we're not rich gays, so unfortunately we couldn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, we're here to talk about movies. And what are we going to be talking about this week?
A movie that we watched.
That is correct. We are going to be talking about a movie that we watched, which was...
I'm sure it has a title, but it escapes me now. With something of Knock at the Door, Cabin in the Something.
Well, you're almost there.
Knock Over the Cabin.
It's Knock at the Cabin.
Yes, Knock at the Cabin. Yes, that wonderful M. Night Shyamalan movie. It's been getting a lot of attention. Some of it's well deserved.
Yes, it is. I would say I'm to preface this. I would say that I'm not like super familiar with M. Night Shyamalan. Like I've watched a smattering of his work, and I know the sort of premise of some of his other stuff. But I would say that this is probably in the top tier of his work, of his filmography, and I think that's a pretty universal assertion. It is
based The Sixth Sense.
It's definitely not as good as The Sixth Sense, but I think that The Sixth Sense is one of those cases that kind of ruined someone's career. Like, yeah. It's just that set the bar so impossibly high that no one could ever sort of scale those heights again. You know, the sort of mixed blessing of such an, you know, such a really audacious success is doomed to never be repeated. Be that as it may, this novel is based on The Cabin at the End of the World, which is a novel by Paul G. Tremblay, which came out a few years ago before this film came out this year. So, in this film, we have Jonathan Groff and Ben Aldridge, the latter of whom is having a really good year, apparently, for movies. We just talked about Spoiler Alert, which he was in last year. They play a gay couple, Eric and Andrew, Groff and Aldridge, respectively, who, with their young daughter, Wen, are vacationing in a cabin in the middle of nowhere when they are accosted by a group of four people led by Dave Bautista's Leonard, who claim that they are trying to prevent the end of the world. And in order for that to happen, one of them must be sacrificed by the other two willingly in order to prevent that. And if they don't, then the apocalypse will come by and the whole world will be destroyed.
Yes. And so this entire movie is really sort of a cautionary tale. For us queers, we should never go to the woods. That is the lesson of this movie.
That's what I assumed that this was, you know, that was the gist of it all. Unless it's Fire Island, don't bother.
Exactly.
Like, there is something I think really interesting. There's some comparisons up to this, I think, in American Horror Story, like 1984, in the sense of, like, the narrative, in order for it to make sense, you kind of just have to roll with it. Yes. Like, I think this is one of those stories where, like, it's so bonkers that you just... I'm like, okay, you, as long as you take the premise straight, if you'll forgive the pun, I think it works. And that's maybe not to everyone's liking, because, I mean, on the face of it, it does seem patently ridiculous.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and as we get into the discussion, that idea of whether or not to take the movie straight becomes the real question, because there are a few things that if you take the movie straight, that just raises some more questions. But, of course, this is M. Night Shyamalan, so that probably shouldn't surprise us that we've got a movie that's just sort of confusing in a few ways.
Yes. So, as you know, obviously Eric and Andrew are very hesitant to do this for good reason, because at first it's from skepticism that these people are actually real. I think they're just either loons or that they're homophobes and hate crime people. But as...
And let's get back to that. So why assume that they're homophobes? Like, why does that assumption come up so quickly?
It's because one of them, Redmond, played by... slash Rory O'Bannon, played by Rupert Grint, who is familiar to us millennials as, of course, Ron Weasley from Harry Potter, is the guy who Andrew believes assaulted him in a bar several years previously. In a pretty violent and brutal way, smashed him in the head with a beer bottle, essentially. So he assumes that all of this is predicated by their desire to, like, target a gay couple.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, in the present environment, that seems like a reason. And they are in the middle of the woods, so presumably in a rural area. So that is a not unsafe assumption to make in 2020, in the year of our Lord 2023, as much as I hate to say that. Mm-hmm. But as they, you know, as they decline each time, each member of the company is killed by the others, which unleashes the, you know, first it's like a huge tsunami that hits the West Coast, mm-hmm. and then it's a plague of a particular flu that targets the young, mm-hmm. and then with a third death, it is airplanes falling from the sky, and then with the last death, which is Leonard, it's like this huge black clouds begins to descend down the earth. So if they don't sacrifice one, the world's going to end, and they'll be the only three left and have to wander through the post-apocalyptic landscape alone. So that's the sort of setup, and I think that it's really effective as a thriller. Like, it begins very effectively. M. Night Shyamalan, whatever his flaws as a screenwriter, is definitely a good craftsman when it comes to putting together movies that kind of keep you riveted. Because he knows how to, like, make scenes fill with suspense and unease. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because he uses a lot of close-ups. Like, there's a lot of moments when we get close-ups of, you know, Leonard's face and others. But also just because he knows how to set the mood.
Yeah.
And I think that when I was reading some reviews, they remarked a lot of this as kind of like a play. Because it's a very limited setting. Almost all of it takes place indoors. And, you know, that can be very stagey and boring, but I don't think that this movie is boring.
No, I actually really appreciated how small this movie was. One, in terms of the running time, comes in at around an hour and a half, which was nice as opposed to the gargantuan three-hour movies that it seemed to be so popular these days. I'm glad that this is a bit more sort of normal length. You get into the story, you get out, you move on. I like that. And I like that that goes along well with the relatively small cast and limited use of locations for this. It's really more of a bijou approach.
Which is
more of a jewel as opposed to just a large smattering of crap. A small jewel.
So just for maybe our more plebeian or, you know, Philistine listeners, could you define bijou for...
That's what I was doing. It's footwork for jewel. Okay. That's why we use it. So something that's small and precious,
right,
rather than something sort of big and rambling.
Right, which I mean, at this point in his career, I think that's a pretty, you know, brave move for Shyamalan. Like, you know, admittedly, a lot of his movies are very derided, and in some cases, rightly so. I'm still annoyed by The Happening being, oh my god, the plants did it. Like, it's just... absolutely absurd. But I really appreciated how this film really kind of sunk its claws into me and didn't let go. Like, I was prepared to be annoyed by this film just because I find sometimes Shyamalan to be a bit precious. But I actually really kind of got into it as it unfolded. And I think that that's largely because we, as you say, we have this very limited setting and these very limited characters that we engage with. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that even though it's a horror film, we don't actually see a lot of horror per se, which, you know, that's, you know, that's a really effective way, I think, of going about this. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't see the deaths as they unfold, like as each member of the cult sacrifices themselves to the others. It just kind of, the camera will pan out to outside, it will pan out so that they're out of the frame. So, you know, I think that's a really effective way of capturing the horror of the moment without actually having us see it. Mm-hmm. So what other things did you enjoy about the film before we begin the critique section?
I've pretty much discussed the things that I had. No, like I said, I like, you know, that the story actually holds together and we move through it at a nice pace. There are some things about it that are meh, but I actually overall did enjoy the story. I found it interesting. It gave me a lot to think about. Mm-hmm. And I thought the performances were good. I thought the interactions between the three who make up the main cast of characters who constitute the family at the center of this, I thought they were all good. Shout out especially to Kristen Kui, who plays young Wynn. You know, young actress, really did a lot with this role and was really impressed with her. I'm hoping to see her in more things as she goes through her career. And of course, the other two, Jonathan Groff and Ben Aldridge, of course, like them as well. So, like I said, there's not a lot that I disliked about the movie, but when we talk about the critiques, I'll say a little bit more.
Right. And I mean, I want to also give credit, because I think that Ben Aldridge is really kind of having a moment, which is good, because I think he's a very good actor. I think he captures Andrew's sense of aggrievement and anger and, like, resentment, and it seems like that's been an issue for him throughout his life. Like, which is why he has a gun.
Right.
And I have to say, I mean, I love Jonathan Groff. What I appreciate about Groff is that he's willing to play characters who are not particularly, like, well, likable.
Mm-hmm.
They're not unlikable, but they're very uptight. Like, mm-hmm. almost every character I've seen him play is so hopelessly repressed, I'm surprised that they are able to function.
Yeah.
And that we only get glimpses of that, but there's a point, because between all of the sort of present day drama, we have these flashbacks where we see the history of Eric and Andrew's relationship. We see them, you know, we get the sense that Andrew's parents are very waspy and don't particularly like their relationship. We see them adopting Wen. We also see them at the bar before the assault happens, where, like, they're sort of airing their grievances mm-hmm. about each other. And there's a moment where Andrew says something in effect of, you can drain the joy out of anything.
Yes.
And I was like, well, yes, that is definitely a very Jonathan Groffian kind of character mm-hmm. trait, and personally mine, because I can also be a little bit, not a killjoy in the sense of being like, well, you know, I'm just kind of high strung mm-hmm. and can really fret about anything, even a moment of what should be enjoyable.
Yes.
Thankfully, Aaron is not like Andrew. He does not have those kind of anger rage problems, thank goodness, because anyway. And I mean, I really, for me, the MVP though of this movie is Dave Bautista. Like, I really find him very charming and charismatic
mm-hmm.
and like what is endearing about Leonard is that he really does seem like a guy who is the true believer, and like, it's kind of heartbreaking how earnest he is mm-hmm. like it's so earnest it almost verges on camp.
Yeah.
And I give it him credit for, like, taking on a very difficult role. Like, mm-hmm. someone who is literally trying to, like, encourage this family to kill one of their own to prevent the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. And, well, to be fair, the two women involved also seem to do that.
That's true.
That. We have, what is it, Sabrina and Adrian.
Right.
That are in there as well, who also seem to be equally true believers with this weird group that they supposedly belong to.
These odd birds, as I believe you would put it. Yes. I give credit to both of the actresses who play that. It's just, I guess, that they're just so much less well-known than Bautista. Like, mm-hmm. he just kind of looms large,
yeah.
both visually and metaphorically.
Yeah, and of course, also, they're not in the movie as long. Out of the four people who show up, he's the one who remains the longest on the scene. The others don't last as long.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, like, he's the one who is the sort of ringleader of this mm-hmm. whole arrangement, as we know from the very beginning, because he's the one who kind of comes up to Wen in the middle of the woods and is kind mm-hmm. of introducing himself to her and playing a game. And there's something oddly soothing about his presence. Like, that takes a lot of skill for someone of Batista's, like, imposing physicality
mm-hmm.
to be so gentle.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. All right, so we did enjoy this film, and I think it works very effectively as a horror thriller. But it does raise some really vexing philosophical questions.
Yes.
And that's the tenor I picked up on some of the more critical reviews for the film. But before we get into that, I have to ask, Aaron, would you sacrifice me to prevent the apocalypse?
Yes. No, just kidding. I was actually thinking about that very question watching the movie, because I think that that's the question we're supposed to think of
mm-hmm.
is one of the central sort of thought-provoking things that comes up in the movie is, what would you do if you were in the situation of this family that was sort of caught in the woods? And I remember, as we were watching, I was thinking about it in two different ways, because I knew you were going to ask me. Not even wait for the pod to ask me. I knew you were going to ask me. I'm surprised you made it through the movie. I'm surprised you didn't just ask me right in the middle. But would I sacrifice you? And I was like, there are two ways I think to think about that. There's the would I sacrifice you if I were like Andrew and didn't believe a word that any of these folks were saying
mm-hmm.
and saw this just sort of as a hostage situation where these folks have come and they're doing this very weird thing where they're not threatening to kill us that they've kept hostage.
Right.
But they're saying one of you needs to kill one of the others or everyone in the world will die.
Right.
So now the question is, if I'm a skeptic like Andrew, would I kill you? Well, absolutely not, because there's no reason to. I don't believe that everyone's going to die and they're not going to kill us. So there's no reason
right.
to do anything. I would just sit there. But then the question that comes up as the movie goes on, because good Lord Eric starts to believe
mm-hmm.
And so now I was like, well, if I believed it were true that the world were actually going to end if one of us didn't kill the other, that's a much more vexing question. But for me, that wasn't the main question of the movie, because Andrew was so skeptical the entire time.
Right.
That only became the question near the end, as Eric started to reveal that maybe he's like, well, maybe there's something to this.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, I will be honest, I would not sacrifice you to save the world. Just even if I, because, you know, I just would not. So that makes me the better person. No, I'm just kidding.
So you would doom our, well, you would doom our loved ones, our families, everyone.
Well, I mean, that is, like, that's the thing that's interesting about this, because I think that's why, and it just occurred to me as I was sitting here, that's why the scene with Andrew's family, I think, is there, mm-hmm. because he doesn't have that attachment exactly. to anyone else. Like, there mm-hmm. is no one else but Eric and Wen. Mm-hmm. He is alone in the world. Mm-hmm. So I think that that makes a difference.
Exactly. And the way that his character is presented, it's not even just that he doesn't have any family. He's a bit more standoffish. It's like we don't see him really making a reference to anybody.
Right.
That he's got, whereas we know that Eric, on the other hand, actually still is close to the rest of his family mm-hmm. and has those kinds of connections and sees himself as connected to the rest of the world in the way that maybe Andrew doesn't.
Right, because there's that moment in that flashback scene where Eric's mom calls to check up and see how things are going.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in that sense, now that I'm thinking about it, it's actually a pretty tight screenplay. Yeah. Like, it's really quite well laid now that I'm thinking about it. And also, I mean, not to get too academic, but we do that sometimes here at Queens of the Bees. Andrew is very much like the queer pessimist. Like, mm-hmm. if we're using that kind of framework of queer theory that says that queer people don't have to, nor should they have an investment in the future, because why bother?
Yeah.
Like, why bother saving the world from capitalism or heterosexuality or all that stuff? Which basically is Andrew comes out and says.
Yeah.
Because he's like, I've seen what humanity is capable of because I'm a civil rights or human rights attorney. So I mm-hmm. know the horrors that humanity can unleash on itself. Why bother?
But exactly. But the problem is that his answer is the explanation. He's a lawyer.
Right.
Like, every day he does the work that he's suggesting is pointless.
Right.
That's one of those things about the movie that I feel didn't work.
Yeah.
It's because I feel like there are a lot of little moments like that where you have to ignore parts of the movie in order for the movie to make sense. Right. Like, his critique would make perfect sense if he weren't actually a human rights lawyer.
Right.
But he is.
Right. And the thing is one could have him know about the atrocities that humans commit without being a human rights lawyer. All exactly. you have to do is be an exactly. educated person.
Exactly. That's why I was like, it added in a detail that actually created a more of a conundrum than clearing up.
Right. Especially since, as you know, because Leonard then goes to the point of showing him like a photograph of his second grade team or whatever. I forget what it exactly it is. It's some kind of kids sports team. And he's like, you know, they're terrible and they lose all the time, but they take so much joy in it. That's mm-hmm. why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
You know, to juxtapose it to Andrew's kind of like pessimism and mm-hmm. skepticism and even cynicism.
Yeah.
But as we say, like, that's a, for all of it, that it's a tight screenplay, there are some kind of glitches where it's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, mm-hmm. if you are someone who is a human rights lawyer and, like, actually goes to the mat for these people, for the mm-hmm. oppressed and the, you know, the brutalized, then why wouldn't you? Like,
exactly. I mean, it's like, in your own little way, it's like you're trying to save the world every day.
Right,
so exactly. why are you so opposed to the idea of saving it now?
Right, I mean, I guess I would say that, you know, I my speculation, if I was to give the screenplay more credit, the implication would be that his assault, which I think has not taken place, they say many years ago, so presume like before Wen, they adopt Wen, so mm-hmm. it's probably what, like 8 years yeah. ago, you know, but clearly maybe that has soured him so that he only does the human rights thing, I don't know, just because, yeah, you know, it's what he did before. I don't know. I mean, obviously, yeah,
exactly, but that's why it just brings up more questions.
Right. Yeah, it requires more work for us as viewers than we should be actually asked to do.
Yeah.
Like, from the screenplay should be self-explanatory mm-hmm. without the. And while we're on the subject, that is one of the plot holes in this. Like, and I use that term very deliberately because the plot hole is something that the film itself creates that doesn't make sense within its own universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing, as we say, that does not make sense.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, there is also the larger question of, you know, why I put this, you know, does it matter that it's a gay couple that is being asked to save the world? and ultimately, as it turns out, is responsible when, at the end of the, as the film reaches its conclusion, Eric, who has inexplicably seen a vision of Andrew and Wen in the future, mm-hmm. which that part's never really explained, so I'm not really sure what's going on there.
It's partly explained by the fact that he was concussed.
Oh, well, yes.
So there's always the question is, did he even see it?
Right. So he's, you know, he sees this future where he's, you know, envisioning Andrew and Wen living the life that is presumably taking place in this happy world, and that he's okay with dying, which mm-hmm. is why Andrew ultimately makes the choice to kill, like, to shoot him and, like, save the world. Mm-hmm. But I have so many questions. Like, I have questions both of the film itself, but also just, like, philosophical questions. So, I mean, first of all, you know, the cultists claim that everything's going to come to an end, but the things that unfold on television are catastrophic, yes, but they don't seem like world-ending.
Yeah, they're not world-ending. And that's something that it's like I've been trying to figure out how I feel about this. Because I think on one hand, it's the movie trying to be a little bit clever
right.
and not have it be, well, it's obviously right that the world is ending. They don't want to reveal that too soon.
Mm.
So, but there does have to be something that suggests that there's a problem going on. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to believe the cult at all.
Right.
So there has to be something. And I think they settle on a nice thing, but having these sort of like disparate, widespread disasters. So different kinds of disasters mm-hmm. happening around the world. I thought was sort of a nice compromise. But as the movie itself pointed out, it's like there's not a real reason why folks would have to see those things as linked.
Exactly. So, you know, as the film unfolds, like they watch television and they can see, like, because they're obviously in the middle of the woods, so they don't have cell phone service. A nice little conceit, mm-hmm. Which contributes to the play aspect. But the first one is like this major earthquake that hits in the Aleutian Islands, and then another one that sends a tsunami crashing toward Oregon, mm-hmm. which I was interested that like they chose Oregon to focus on. Like, if you're gonna like make the claim about like a huge national disaster, why would it be one of the more coastal California cities where the population density is so much more? Mm-hmm. Or Seattle, for that. Anyway, we don't need to get into the weeds of that. And then, of course, there's the plague, but that's only a few isolated places. The one that really seems to land is when the air, like 700 flights or something, crash into the earth. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the one that seems to land the most effectively.
Yeah.
It's also the most visually effective.
Mm-hmm. But it's also the one that it has to be kind of like a ridiculous number of flights.
Right.
Because any one plane crashing, even if it's a huge plane, it's a couple of hundred people in
right.
danger. Unlike, you know, the many, many thousands that can be killed with one manifestation of any of these other disasters.
Right.
And so they can only show, you know, the fallout from like one plane crash.
Right.
And so it's like maybe dozens to a few hundred people die as opposed to tens to hundreds of thousands.
Right. I mean, I guess I'm saying that if I was one of the people sitting held captive by this cult, it would seem to me like a string of coincidences that happen every day. Like, I mean, admittedly, planes that fall in the sky every day. But, you know, earthquakes and a plague happen relatively frequently, as we know in the age of COVID. Like, that doesn't seem that inexplicable. I'm just thinking that if I was sitting there being asked to sacrifice someone, would I be convinced?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I would be.
Well, I don't know. But especially since you mentioned COVID, I think that in a post-COVID world, people might even be more responsive to that, with that idea of that plague that breaks out in Edinburgh and other places.
Oh, right. Since we just were in Edinburgh. So there's an interesting like tension, I think, going on there,
mm-hmm.
With these kind of unfolding things. And then, of course, the final one, once Leonard takes his own life, is this ominous black cloud that is, it works, I suppose. It's kind of just the ambiguous mm-hmm. end of the world kind of apocalyptic imagery that's yeah. not particularly like unique, but it works for what this is trying to do.
Right. And I just thought of something that I didn't think of when we were watching the movie yesterday. About the idea of all of these sort of different things happening, and you were like, well, it sounds like a lot of these are things that happen kind of all the time, especially, you know, now with post-COVID and all that kind of stuff. These are things that we should be used to. That actually, to me, sort of makes the movie make a little bit more sense. It's like I can understand better now how there might be this group of random folks that are just so convinced that the world is ending because of the things that happen
right.
every day. I could see maybe someone who's maybe a little, maybe at the end of their rope, a little bit desperate,
mm-hmm.
looking out for something, because maybe they have gotten to the point where they're like, the world really is ending.
Right.
Like, things are so bad that it's actually all going to be over.
Right. So, I mean, of course, you know, that's what makes it all the more, I think, significant that it's just happenstance. And this is one thing we were talking about in the pregame of, like, it's not deliberate that the people charged with basically saving the world are queer. It's just kind of an accident because, like, they have – Leonard and the others have no way of knowing before mm-hmm. they arrive at the cabin who's going to be there.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I said before but when we get to the critiques that I would sort of bring up because – there is this question of, because there's a long-standing trope in movies and other things, of queer people being sacrificed.
Right.
You know, for the greater good in some way or another. That's a fairly long-standing trope. And this movie sort of dances around with that as its central conceit.
Right.
Because you've got this queer family that's been asked to make this sacrifice on behalf of the world. But, as you point out, it happens, if we accept the movie on its own terms, that request of this queer couple was accidentally made of a queer couple because the members of this group explicitly point out that they didn't actually know that it was two men
right.
with a kid. When they came there, they were expecting a different kind of family to be there when they showed up.
Right.
And so it really is just a coincidence. But that's juxtaposed against the idea that supposedly Redmond, Rupert Grint's character, really was a homophobe targeting Andrew because he had attacked him in the past and right. found him again to attack him again.
Right.
Which also seems to be true because at first it's, we don't even know if he really is the guy from the past. He just sort of looks like the guy that attacked Andrew years
right.
in the past. And of course he was hurt badly when it happened. He maybe didn't remember. It's been a long time. He didn't even get that good look at the guy when it happened. So, of course, maybe it was just a mistake.
And neither did we in the flashbacks.
Exactly. But then it turns out that he was actually right, that it was the same guy. So then that lends credence to the idea that this was supposed to be a hate crime. But if so, how do you jive that with the idea that the rest of them had no clue who these people were?
Right.
It's like, did Redmond lead them there? But he wasn't the leader of the group, so
right. Is it just a cosmic accident? Like,
you know,
like,
I mean, is it all just honestly just a coincidence? And if it is, what are we as an audience supposed to do with that?
Yes, and that's the thing. I mean, like, when I think, it's one of those things where, like, the film works only if you don't think about it too carefully. Mm-hmm. Which, for a film that is so self-consciously philosophical, like, it
yes.
can't help but be philosophical. Like, I know that, you know, as we say here at Queens of the Bees all the time, and as I argue as a critic frequently, we have to take films on their own terms, but on its own terms, it is straightforwardly a film that asks philosophical questions.
Yes.
It's not just a thriller where people get slashed to death.
Exactly.
Like, it's, or that, you know, it's not just a funny games kind of, like, torture porn. Like, it's an actual engagement with thorny philosophical questions, as mm-hmm. good horror often is. But in that case, then it has to have its, it should at least try to have some kind of internal coherence, but I'm not sure that it does. And the more that I think about it, and the more we talk about it, the more the sort of tapestry starts to fall apart.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, that's not to say that the film is bad or not enjoyable. It's just, like, those seeking some kind of internal, like, philosophical mm-hmm. coherence to this film might be disappointed.
Yeah, and I can tolerate, you know, the kind of movie where you might say we're not supposed to think about it very much. Like, I can accept that
right.
as an argument. There, I've enjoyed many movies that you might say that about. The point is you're not supposed to think about it. But as you point out, we're supposed to be thinking all the way through this movie.
Right.
And so it feels weird to run into those moments where it's like, don't think about this.
Right.
You know, think deeply about the movie except for this stuff.
Right.
That kind of seems to be what the movie's asking us to do, and I don't like that.
Yeah. And I mean, what is particularly striking is that, you know, I have not read the book, but I've read the summary, so I kind of know how the movie differs from the book, and it's a very significant difference, and this is one of the things that people, those who had read Tremblay's book, were very, very disappointed, is that the book is actually significantly more depressing
yeah.
than the movie.
How so?
So in the book, while, you know, after, at some point, this happens in the movie too, Andrew manages to get to the car and gets the gun, which that raises this whole question, like, why did you keep your gun in the car? Like, why didn't you keep it in the house? I mean, like, anyway. So he comes back, and at some point he's wrestling with Leonard with the gun, and the gun goes off and kills Wen. So, unfortunately, though, that does not fulfill the contract, the sort of cosmic contract, because it's not done willingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, at that, you know, Leonard kills himself and the apocalypse is now impending. So Eric and Andrew decide, rather than, in, like, doing the sacrifice. They're like, well, I don't want, you know, who cares, ultimately, is the sort of gist of the argument. And they end up driving off to meet whatever the future holds. Like, so that's a very different kind of ending than what we get in the movie version. Mm. And I mean, on the one hand, I can understand why Shyamalan's adaptation would jettison that more pessimistic or, you know, ambiguous ending for a more sort of traditional Hollywood ending. Mm. But I do think that that does take some of the teeth out of what could have been a really compelling philosophical argument.
Yeah. And then also, were there other differences in the book, like in terms of what happens to, like, Wynne? Is there something different?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I asked her this briefly. She actually dies. Like, she does get shot accidentally in the book, but not in the movie.
Yeah.
Which I'm really glad of, because I would have probably been very devastated if Wynne had been shot. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that Hollywood movies could accommodate that kind of bleakness. Yeah. Now, this was an HBO drama, absolutely, because that kind of shit happens all the time mm-hmm. on HBO. But as a sort of, you know, mainstream Hollywood film, I'm just not sure even now that risk-averse Hollywood would ever be willing to give that kind of screenplay a green light.
Right.
But, like I said, I mean, I think that unfortunately, the consequence of that is that the film is not nearly as thought-provoking or as challenging as it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Or even as rewarding. Because ultimately, you know, as the film kind of reaches its conclusion, you know, Eric is dead. And then somehow, like, for some reason, lightning strikes and then the whole cabin goes up in flames. It's very, like, traditional Hollywood ending. And then Andrew and Wynne drive off and stop at this diner where, for some reason, in the middle of nowhere, they're listening to, like, the BBC, I guess, which doesn't make any sense, but that's neither here nor there.
It's a cable channel. It shows.
Well, I know, but I mean, if I'm in the middle of nowhere at a diner in the middle of Pennsylvania, I can guarantee you that the news station they're going to be listening to is not going to be the BBC.
Wow, way to stereotype.
It's true. It would probably be either CNN or Fox News. But anyway, so just a little break of verisimilitude, yes. I have to say.
I don't know. I'm not going to be so stereotypical in my thinking about this. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't be too surprised to find folks at a diner looking at BBC as opposed to Fox News or something like that.
Well, as the person who grew up in rural Pennsylvania, anyway, don't get me distracted. The important thing here is that, you know, they stop at the diner, they see the consequences that, you know, the world immediately starts building itself back, and then they drive off into the distance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very traditional kind of Hollywood ending. And it was, I don't know, how did you feel about it? I was dissatisfied, but only because I knew how the book ended.
Yeah.
But how did you feel about the ending?
I thought it was fine. You know, given the other things that happened that we already talked about that I actually had bigger problems with, the actual ending I thought was okay.
Mm. Okay. I mean, like I said, I wish kind of that it had been a little more in tune with the novel. Like, if anything, I would have liked to have seen when Andrew and Eric drive off together. Like, that would have made me more satisfied rather than the kind of, like, sacrifice that Eric himself undertakes.
Yeah, whereas I feel like I think all three riding off into the sunset for me would have felt a little cheesier. I'm glad one of them ended up dead. Like, I don't think I could have handled it if it was Wynne. If it had been the kid, I wouldn't have liked that. But I'm glad it was one of them, because for me that made the stakes matter. It's like after everything else had happened, it was like I felt like for the movie, one of them had to go.
Right.
It's like they couldn't just sort of like be left ultimately unchanged as a family dynamic. I think something needed to happen like this.
Right. I guess what it comes down to is I just didn't feel particularly like I found myself emotionally invested only insofar as like I found the thriller aspect in like affecting, like I found myself responding to that. I have to say though that I did not find, and I found the parents' relationship with Wynne moving, but I didn't find the bond between Eric and Andrew to be particularly convincing, and I'm not sure why. And I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I just didn't feel like they were a couple with whom I didn't feel like there was a strong relationship there, or I wasn't invested. So like Eric's sacrifice didn't really resonate with me. But I don't know how you felt.
And for me, it worked because there's the scene earlier on where they're, you know, telling each other about themselves, essentially, like saying the things that they have problems with, that to me at least indicated that this was a couple that's, like, they've had issues, they've had problems, but they've figured out a way to work through it. Mm. So it's not like, this isn't like storybook romance couple, it's actual real life couple with real life problems. But they've decided to be committed to one another. That's how I kind of read their relationship.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and I will agree that there are some nice, like, sort of vignettes where we see their relationship. Like, when they go, they all jump into the water, which we get to see Ben Aldridge with his shirt off. That's always a plus. You know, they play the Boogie Shoes song. Mm-hmm. Like, those, are, I think, are nice. I guess what it comes down to is, like, as a viewer, I still am skeptical. Maybe I'm skeptical both diegetically of whether these kooks are actually, like, correct. And I'm also skeptical of the movie's message that we should pay attention to crazy, like, religious lunatics who are, you know, assuming that they're, the film suggests that such people may actually have a point.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, the reviewer for The New Yorker was kind of, like, not particularly happy with that conclusion that the film reaches, and I kind of found myself agreeing, just because I find, like, that, you know, we live in an age of chronic and, like, perpetual and misinformation, and, like, people who, like, buy into all sorts of crazy things, and I'm just like, I don't particularly find this to be that convincing.
Yeah, and I get that, because part of me feels the same way, but part of me is also like, every outsider story has that same structure, though. And so, and I say that, I don't just mean narratives used in, like, movies. I mean, like, in real life, like, the outsider story is often the person who's framed as crazy.
Right.
But they're actually right. And it just takes a lot for the rest of us to come around to realizing that that crazy person wasn't actually crazy. They were right.
Right.
And so that's one reason why, like, as a movie, I would never hold that against the movie. Because that would force me to take on a philosophical and political position that I'm not willing to take on. Because in real life, the crazy person isn't always crazy. And because the crazy person isn't always crazy, I can't delegitimize that as a narrative strategy.
I think we may have to agree to a disagree on that point. But, I mean, overall, I mean, I just think that that's a bold but perhaps vexing choice to make in 2023, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, but to be fair, you could say that at any time. I know it feels good to say that in 2023 now, because that's what we're living now, but we could literally have said that if we were making this podcast in any year, because there's always been weird shit that didn't make sense that people believe that's not real. If this was the late 80s, we could be saying the same thing about the Satanic Panic. This has always been the problem.
Which was also not real.
Exactly.
That's my point.
Exactly. But just for every person or every group that's been completely insane, like the folks that believed in the Satanic Panic, like the folks in this movie who believe in this doomsday apocalypse thing, for every person that's just flat out crazy, or for every time there's been flat out crazy people saying crazy things that don't make any sense, there have also been real people talking about real problems that have just been dismissed as crazy. That's why I said I can't dismiss it as a narrative strategy.
Right.
Because it happens in real life that the crazy person is sometimes not actually crazy.
Right. I mean, it's one of those cases where, like, I think that the film, for all of its narrative flaws and, like, certain disjunctures, shall we say, I think does, you know, like the novel on which it's based, does ask some, like, pretty interesting questions, like, philosophically. Like, at the end of the day, like, it does seem like part of the drive of the characters is to, you know, the skepticism of Andrew is ultimately overcome by the more mysticism of Eric.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there's still something to be said that, you know, it may yet be that the case that all of these characters were just imposing order on actual chaos.
Yes, exactly.
It's like there is at least a little germ of ambiguity. I would have liked it if there'd been more ambiguity rather than the sort of, like, definitive answer that we seem to get that Hollywood narrative kind of demands. I guess that's what I'm getting
exactly
at.
And I agree with you there. It's like I would much greatly have preferred to just leave this completely open,
right?
Like, make it so that we really don't know.
Right. Especially, you know, cuz it does seem from the film's point of view pretty clear that Eric certainly is convinced of the rightness of what they're doing in his own sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that Eric is completely convinced. But he's kind of shell-shocked by the end.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, the fact that Eric is concussed also injects a little note of ambiguity, because, like, I very highly doubt that he had this vision of, like, their future where these two were happy mm-hmm. together.
Exactly, but we just don't know.
Right.
And I think maybe the movie's trying to be a thing where the movie itself just sort of doesn't know, but I'm not always a big fan of that as a strategy.
Right.
Like, I tend to like it where a movie will present enough ambiguity that it's fair for as audiences for us to be like, we really don't know, but maybe for the makers of the movie to be like, yeah, but we have an idea of what happened.
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, this is a TV show, but like the end of Ozark, for example, mm-hmm. there is just a faintest bit of ambiguity about which one Jonah chooses to shoot,
mm-hmm.
even though the director and the creators like, actually, no, it's clear that he shot the private investigator, not his family.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's enough ambiguity there, but the certainty is still also there.
Exactly.
I would have preferred that kind of more audacious move on the film's part, because I think it would have been more in keeping to the spirit of the novel
mm-hmm.
as opposed to this version. Yes. So, you know, which of course brings us to, you know, back to Shyamalan, who is, if I would use the word infamous for using twist endings, starting with The Sixth Sense in the, you know, not spoiler alert, that Bruce Willis's character has been dead the whole time.
What?
I know, right? Surprising. You know, that at this point in his career, like, he's kind of turned that into, like, it's almost self-referential.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, when this film came out, a lot of people were like, well, the twist is there is no twist. So it's like the biggest twist of all is that there is no twist. So, you know, that's what I sort of come down on, that, like, you know, that's what's going on here.
The twist was the friends we made along the way.
The twist was the lovers that we sacrificed along the way.
Yes.
That's the real twist. So I guess what the takeaway is that I did find myself enjoying this film much more than I have with previous Shyamalan films. And I do think that it does raise a number of really interesting questions. And for that, I think it deserves credit.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, quite honestly, it is kind of nice to see gay people getting to decide the fate of the world, even if one of them has to die to do so. But it's at least they sacrifice because they're a family, not because they're queer. And I like that we get that reinforced several mm-hmm. times, that it's not their queerness that makes them ripe for sacrifice. But I don't know what that leaves us with. I don't know if this film will become like canonical, but I thought it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. But to end on that point, something that I do like about that idea is that even if we think of this, or especially if we think of this as just sort of a complete accident, that, you know, this queer family wasn't chosen for their queerness, they just happened to be wrong place, wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
I actually kind of like that. Again, you've heard me folks say this a bunch of times in a lot of our episodes, that I really like it when movies and shows sort of depict queer folks as just like
mm-hmm.
everybody else. This could have been any family, so why not a gay family?
Right.
There you go. I like that.
Yeah, it's a nice cosmic accident.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I think that's a pretty good place to stop. It seems like we've done a pretty good job excavating the many hidden depths of this film. So if you haven't seen it, it's now streaming on Peacock. We definitely recommend it. I think it is pretty good and deserves, you know, some critical love and appreciation from viewers. So we'll be right back with you to do a little PSK. All right, so we're not going to do an Are You Even Gay this week. Neither Aaron nor myself had any to go with.
Neither of us are gay.
That's the twist. That's the M. Night...
You just heard it, folks. We've admitted it.
That's the M. Night Shyamalan-esque twist that we were not gay all along. But I did want to return to an issue that we raised last week, just because it's worth revisiting, which, of course, is the issue of trans lives. And I just need to reiterate that trans lives matter, and because we are releasing this episode about a week after the Trans Day of Visibility, but I think that's important, nevertheless. Mm-hmm. And I say this because, obviously, there was the tragic shooting in Nashville, and the perpetrator of that shooting may have been trans, which, of course, many figures on the right are leaping on that to, you know, be like, it's not the guy, as for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene was like, it's not the guns, it's the testosterone and the something or other. I don't remember exactly what she said. But obviously the right is going to use this as a bludgeon to, well, sorry, as a cudgel with which to bludgeon LGBTQ people writ large. And I just think we need to really caution and like try to not try to avoid falling into that trap and to not take them on their own terms. Because that's the problem we continually have, is having to engage with these people when we shouldn't even be talking to them at all.
Whereas I think we should always be talking to people.
Go on.
Sometimes what we should be saying to people is go fuck yourself. But I think we should always be talking to them.
Right.
Because I agree with you. I think that the big mistake that we make is when we engage in conversation, we on the left almost always end up taking the other side on their terms.
That's what I meant.
We need to keep talking, but stop doing that.
Yes.
Reframe the conversation around what's actually correct, around actual correct information about people.
And right.
All that kind of stuff, rather than taking the faulty, hateful rhetoric from the right as a given.
Right.
Point out that it's wrong.
Yes. Which brings me to another subject, and this is related to, like, so there's a movement on Twitter, and as we know, Twitter's not real life. I get that. But it does have, for better and often for the worst, it does have real world effects in many ways. And unfortunately, there is a growing presence of LGB without the TQ, or I don't know, whatever other way they want to find to divide the the alphabet. Now, to be fair, I do think that the alphabet gets a bit unwieldy and silly sometimes. And I think that it's sometimes it's more useful to say that we're all queer for all that. There's also a movement to like abandon queer as a term, although I thought we had this debate 30 years ago, but apparently not. But I have a point that I'm getting to in my own meandering way, which I'm noticing a lot of my friends that I follow on Twitter, they won't retweet someone, but they'll frame capture them so you can still see their username. And then they'll like respond to it. But when you click the username, often these people have like, I don't know, 33, 100 followers, but they get more the more we engage with them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real problem that the left, in its desire to, you know, in its well-meaning desire to educate people or to like push back against these voices, inadvertently elevate them.
Yep.
And that has been happening for the last decade and a half, pretty much since Twitter became a major part of the political landscape.
Yep.
But I really need to like push this out there. I thought about tweeting it, but then I thought, well, that's just that's the conundrum, right? Speaking of, you know, inconsistencies. But we really need to not do that. We cannot and should not be raising up these voices that, you know, they have a pittance of Twitter followers, so their influence is minimal, but we give them more when we draw attention to them.
Yep, don't feed the trolls. How many times does it need to be said?
Apparently a lot. I see this happen a lot. Like, I see people that I follow, people that I respect, people who I know have their hearts in the right place, will, you know, retweet or engage with someone on Twitter, and then I go to the person they're engaging with to see, well, maybe this is some alt-right figure, I don't know, someone with a lot of clout, and they almost never have clout, but they get it because they keep riling us up, and we take the bait every time.
Yep.
And this is why media literacy is so important, because it teaches us how to determine what's important and what is not, and what is worth engaging with and what isn't.
And it's also important for us to think about the way that we think about our own activism, because unfortunately something that we do, and I'm guilty of this too, is that one reason why we often engage with those obvious trolls is because we like the feeling it gives us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it feels like we've done something real, that we've fought an important battle, that we've done something that made a difference, when really, we just sort of involved ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, this is, case in point, is the LGB without the TQ, or it was an actual Twitter, like, account. But it had, like, I don't know, a small number of followers, but I saw more and more people with engaging it, including people who have a lot of followers, and I'm like, you need to stop. Like, the algorithm rewards this.
It's like, and you just took that thing and now you've elevated it and made it influential when you were trying to fight against it.
Exactly. And I was like, how can I talk about this and get this in the public without tweeting and contributing to the problem? Here we are on Queens of the Bees. That's why I brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And my last thing is that, you know, on that subject, is that now Marjorie Taylor Greene is being engaged with and profiled by 60 Minutes. And I really, if anything brings our democracy crashing to the ground, it will be this, is the constant engaging with and giving credibility to the most bizarre voices, which is oddly germane, actually, to the movie that we just discussed. Yeah. Like,
well, unfortunately with Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's now, sadly, a very high-ranking Republican official. So it kind of makes sense that she's going to get proven out.
Well, I know, but we can still make the choice to not do that. Like, I mean, that's how she got there to start with, was, you know, being able to leverage the attention economy.
Yeah, but that's unfortunate. It's like the problem is that it had already worked. With her. She weaseled her way, and I use that term very deliberately for Marjorie Taylor Greene. She weaseled her way into that position, but now she's in it. It's kind of like how we couldn't ignore Trump for the 4 years that he was actually president. As much as tempting as it was for people like me to say, just ignore him. The problem was that during the 4 years of his term, you couldn't do that.
Right. Which, I mean, this is my frustration with the film, and I suspect maybe more from just like the cultural problem than the film itself.
Yeah.
So this is what I was getting at when we were having our talk during the film discussion about like giving credibility and credence to the crazy people, because then it just makes them believe that they're actually correct.
Exactly.
And the film seems to come down on the side that yes, the crazy people are correct.
Exactly. But like I was saying before, the reason why I won't dismiss it as a strategy is because the same thing could be said back when we first finally started talking about the idea that there are lots of men who like to rape women.
Right.
Women were told they were crazy.
True.
When they would come forward and say these things.
Right.
You know, when people started talking about the sex abuse scandal with the Catholic Church.
Right.
We said they were crazy.
Well, that's
turned out they actually weren't.
That's fair. I know. I'm just saying that, like, it's a complicated problem, and we're not going to solve it here on Queens, but it's nevertheless something we really wanted to talk about, because I do think that, like, we can all do our part to stop creating these figures who thrive on attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, we want attention, but we're good people, and we're doing the good. Mm-hmm. We're fighting the good fight.
Exactly. So, again, you just highlighted the conundrum. You know, and I say all that not just to dig at TJ, of course, but to highlight the fact that this really is complicated. Like, there are no real simple answers for any of this stuff.
Right. Which is why, you know, a movie like Knock at the Cabin is interesting, because it does provide an easy solution. It's ultimately like a narratively easy solution, which is part of the reason we watch movies, is so that they give us narratively easy solutions to difficult life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on that happy thought. I guess we'll leave you all with that little bit of ambiguity.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you as always for tuning in to Queens of the Bees. We really do appreciate hearing from listeners. Like, I occasionally, you know, will engage with people on Grindr who listen to the pod and they like us. And, you know, in the words of the immortal Sally Field, you love us. You really like us. You like us. You really like us. But we appreciate that. That being said, we do appreciate also all of you who've taken the time to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple or where have you. We do appreciate that as well. Now, I'm going to say something here, and Aaron's going to mock me, but I will say that if you want to leave us criticism, we will gladly take it. Unlike some oversensitive celebrities, I think that criticism is good. So if you have suggestions for improvement, don't be afraid to reach out or leave us, you know, in the reviews. Be kind, you know, be constructive. Don't just be, you know, assholes, obviously. But constructive criticism is helpful, and it makes us better here at Queens of the Bees. For example, someone left me a comment a while ago that the sound was off, so I fixed that. That was an example. I responded to the criticism appropriately. It was very helpful. So please, if you have something to say, please do so.
Alright.
So that's growth for me. That is, as I approach middle age, I feel like I can be a little more zen about criticism.
Yes.
On the other hand, I will cry, but I will accept it.
Yes. He won't actually cry.
A lot.
He will cry.
A lot. So please do, if you have that. You can also follow us on our various social media channels. You can follow me at Twitter at TJ Weston, the number 3. You can follow me on Instagram at Thomas Weston, the number 3. You can also follow our Queens of the Bees account at Queens of the Bees, without the apostrophe. And lastly, you can also follow us, or you can follow me personally on Letterboxd at Thomas West 3. So, and then I promise this is the last recommendation. You can also follow my Substack newsletter, Omnivorous, where I frequently write about gay stuff, including some write-ups of the kind of things that we talk about here on the pod. I'm not even going to bother asking Aaron where to find him on social media.
You can always ask.
But I know better, because he wisely is not as plugged into the world of Twitter and other social spaces as I am. which is why he doesn't know all the gay stuff that's going on.
I've seen the Twitter tweet thing before.
Yeah, it's best avoided. So you've definitely... Maintaining your mental health is important. So, that being said, thank you again for tuning in to Queens of the Bees. I am TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will see you next week.